Well, ladies and gentlemen, I hope you had a good lunch break and are ready for more wonderful revelations from the unknown that we seem to be in a place of inundation in terms of quality and intensity and clarity. So and I'm sure that our next speaker, Gregory Van Dam, will continue in this mode. So Gregory is a scholar specializing in classical Sufi thought, particularly the works of Ibn Arabi and his commentators. He holds a PhD in religious studies from UC Leuven, where his dissertation focused on the concept of hayra, perplexity, and he's got a talk on the YouTube on the subject, exploring and hayra, exploring its implications in epistemology, metaphysics, and Quranic hermeneutics. Currently, well, this was written a little while ago. Currently, he is on Barzakh. He's a man. He's a bit become a man of the Barzakh. He's actually between doing his postdoctoral research at the University of Chester, and then following his research as a research fellow at UC Leuven, where he is now going back to after being with Chester. So that's what I mean. The Barzakh, he's moving between these various things, and he's a guest lecturer at Sciences Po Paris. His research primarily delves into the doctrines of speculative mysticism, Quranic hermeneutics, and spiritual education in Sufism. So you're just in the right place, Gregory, and we look forward to what you are going to bring to us. Thank you.
Thank you for this very generous presentation. I want first to thank everybody at the Ibn Arabi Society and the Warburg Institute. It's truly an honor and a joy to be here among some such distinguished colleagues and professors. So I wanted to contribute to the conference theme, the body as metaphor of divine self-revelation, through a meditation on the presence of the body in a well-known Ibn Arabi's work, Kitab al-Tadbirat al-Ilahiyya. And I think it gives important insights, as we will see, because Ibn Arabi's metaphysics and cosmology are actually structured across multiple intermediate levels. So instead of a mirror, we have more prisms than mirrors. The reflection of the divine within the human body passes through a series of prismatic mediations, chief among them the reality of the perfect human being, of course. But as with most of Ibn Arabi's central concepts, the notion of insan and kamil, of perfect human, raises actually more questions than it offers clear-cut doctrinal answers. Foremost among these is whether the perfect human represents a unique and universal reality in which the multitude of individual human beings, sorry, each participate in their own way and to their own degree. But if this is a metaphysical or spiritual reality, what then is the place of the body, of embodied human experience within the reality of the perfect human? Just to make it clear, the image has nothing to do directly with Ibn Arabi nor Andalusia, because it's coming from Tipu Sultan Album of the Saints. But it shows that notion of Insan and Kamil, famously coined by Ibn Arabi himself, went as far as 18th century India. A useful treatise by Ibn Arabi, outwardly well known as it has been the subject of both traditional commentaries and modern translations, offers particularly rich and at times unexpected insights into the question of the body of the perfect human being. It is the Kitab al-Tadbirat al-Ilahiyya fi Islah al-Mamlaka al-Insaniya, the book of divine governances for the ordering of the human kingdom. The book is well known because it was first edited by Nyberg in his Kleinere Schriften, das in Arabi, in 1919, an edition which served as the basis for later translations into both English and French, but an edition, as it is usually the case, that was based on late sources, on late copies of the manuscripts, whereas we actually possess early manuscripts dating even from Ibn Arabi's own lifetime in Leiden, in Istanbul. So we worked during a long time, both in the Arab world, because most of the other Arabic editions of the Tadbirat, and in the Western world, we worked on a kind of hybrid version of the text, and the version of the Tadbirat is only recently assured. So what is the Tadbirat al-Ilahiyya? The Tadbirat al-Ilahiyya is an answer, sorry. The Tadbirat al-Ilahiyya is a Sufi response to the Sir al-Asrar. The Sir al-Asrar is a text well known in the medieval tradition. It is a pseudo-Aristotelian treatise that is presented as Aristotle's teachings to Alexander the Great on how to govern his empire. It is already the Sir al-Asrar, so a classical Hellenistic text translated into Arabic. It is already imbued with esoteric elements, and for instance, the use of physiognomy, which closely parallels and explains the presence of a section on Firasa in the Tadbirat. So the Sir al-Asrar was an esoteric text from Hellenistic origin circulating in Islamic lands. And Ibn Arabi, in his early days, went to one of the masters he visited, Sheikh al-Mawruri, and Sheikh al-Mawruri asked him to pen an answer, a Sufi answer to the Sir al-Asrar, which is the Kitab Tadbirat al-Ilahiyya. It is therefore also a treatise on the governance of the human kingdom, what Ibn Arabi calls the Siyasat al-Mamlaka al-Insaniya, the politics of the divine kingdom, as we will see. But he's, as I said about physiognomy and firasa, is clearly answering, is trying to work on the basis of the Sir al-Asrar. Making things out of his own experience or out of his own ideas. He's answering to those classical, mainly Hellenistic ideas. The Tadbirat is of particular importance in the study of the thought of Ibn Arabi because it offers a vision of what was actually Sufism, what was Tasawwuf for Ibn Arabi. It's maybe the more Sufi text of Ibn Arabi because the introduction presents the work as a prelude to all the sciences of Tasawwuf, and it has a dedicated Muqaddima on Tasawwuf. It's, to my knowledge, the only work of Ibn Arabi in which he clearly is clearly talking about Tasawwuf, is always, of course, referring to Sufi masters. But you know the famous anecdote that he only heard the word Tasawwuf the first time he read Risalat Qushayriya, that was quite a long time after his initial illuminative experience, so that he's not properly a Sufi per se, and that Sufism in the Far West wasn't as developed and as institution and as in the East. So here with the Tadbirat, we have actually Ibn Arabi's take on what is Tasawwuf, which is interesting. But it also reflects the specificity of the Andalusian intellectual landscape, which was marked by a concordance between natural sciences, philosophy, and occult sciences, as we can see in the famous work of the Mu'tabirun of Ibn al-Masarra, or the pseudo-Ibn al-Masarra, as we were talking during the lunch break, and of the famous encyclopedia of Ikhwan al-Safa that was widely circulating in Andalus. So it is Ibn Arabi's work on Sufism. It is a work on Sufism, but the apart from that introduction on Sufism, the rest of the work clearly differs from what is found in classical Sufi literature of the same period. But what is perhaps the most typically Sufi aspect of the text here is that it is clearly oriented towards a practical aim, as we shall see, even though it is also highly speculative in nature. So it is a practical treatise. It's not a only metaphysical theory or metaphysical speculation. It is a practical treatise of Sufism. So it must therefore be read with this practical orientation in mind. I think it's very important. So what is the content of the work? The work and its practical aim are fully grounded in the perspective of the correspondence between macrocosm and microcosm, a framework here closely aligned with the classical dichotomy between Zahir and Batin, which refers at once to the apparent and the hidden, the manifest and the latent, the outward and the inward. That's clearly the frame here of Ibn Arabi's reflection of on the human kingdom. In this perspective, the human being is presented as the interface, the barzakh, or the in-between, connecting all the levels and the realities of divine manifestation, as well as the mediator of divine action on earth. This is the meaning of the notion of caliph in the work. The caliph is, of course, the perfect human being, but it is the perfect human being in as much as he is mediating divine action on earth. The central theme and interlocutor of the Tadbirat is thus that caliph, which is the spirit, ruh, understood as the caliph of creation, as we shall see. It is from the spirit, defined here as a in a very broad, universal, and metaphysical meaning, from that spirit that the subsistence of the kingdom of a human being, both macrocosmic and microcosmic, proceeds. And the practical aim of the book is thus salvation. Salvation through the spirit. It therefore focuses on the source of that salvation, which is the caliph himself as mediator of salvation. We need to find the caliph to find salvation, as Ibn Arabi himself puts it here. Each section of the book offers instructions for realizing unity, which is the gift of God to humanity. They show how to preserve order within the divine order while cultivating self-improvement, how to guide our lives in the right direction, how to protect one's kingdom, the human being, from forgetfulness, and how to govern it as it ought to be governed by the spirit, which is its caliph. So the work combines therefore the genres of mirror for princes and the ideal city in order to lead the reader to recognize within himself the presence of the caliphate of the spirit and to entrust it with the governance of his being. The political dimension is not an allegory, actually. It is the political dimension here is not an allegory. On the contrary, it arises from the reflection within the human kingdom of the metaphysical realities addressed in the work. As one of the commentators on the work, Al-Baitamani, says, God did not create Adam, the caliph, in the image of kings. Rather, he created kings in the image of the caliph. So those political realities that the work is using to talk about the caliphate of the spirit are not allegorical figure of speech. The reality is that they are themselves images of the reality of the spiritual caliphate. So talking about that commentator, Al-Baitamani, there are two traditional commentaries. As I said, well, we have two extant traditional commentaries, but we can imagine that there have been an early oral tradition of commentary on the Tadbirat al-Ilahiyya, because, as I said, we have different manuscripts copied during Ibn Arabi's lifetime that seems to have been the support of oral teachings around the text. And interestingly enough, we have also marginal note records on a manuscript held at Paris National Library that records that the famous Ibn Hud, I don't know if you know of him, but a very famous original figure from the end of the 13th century, that Ibn Hud taught the work to one unknown disciple, Al-Tikriti, and that he was a transmitter of teaching of Ibn Arabi around the text. But then two commentaries emerge from major Arab Ottoman centers of thought, one in Damascus and one in Cairo. And in both those commentaries, the text was approached as a practical Sufi teaching. So it was not used as the basis for political thought. It was not used as a compendium on metaphysics, which it could be actually, but rather as a practical Sufi manual. The commentaries often served as pretext for developing other doctrines by the commentators, such as the Muhammadan reality, or occasionalism, or Ash'arid doctrine of Kasb, but which will not be of interest for us. The first one is by Ibn Tuma'a al-Baytamani from Damascus, who was a disciple of a well-known commentator on Ibn Arabi, al-Nabulusi, and who coined other interesting works on Ibn Arabi. And the second one is from a quite unknown figure. We just know that Damuni, we just know that he was affiliated with the very influential tariqah of Sajadat al-Bakriya in Cairo. But it shows that the commentary until very late, until the end of 18th century, the text was the locus of interesting commentary. In the present study, those commentaries will be used only in a secondary capacity, mainly to shed light on how the text has been read across generations. But I will focus mainly on the Tadbirat itself and on the work of and the words of Ibn Arabi. And the aim of my presentation is to reread the Tadbirat through the lens of the body, because, as I said, it is a treatise that talks about the spirit, that is centered at the spirit, that, as we will see, is even addressing in us the reality of the spirit. So what about the body? So I will try to read the Tadbirat through the body, to set aside the apparent structure of the work and the doctrinal self-evidence in order to uncover what it truly offers regarding the question of embodiment of the caliph. Of course, this inquiry should not be disconnected from Ibn Arabi's broader corpus, especially in the Futuhat, in which there are many resonances and further developments of the notions deployed here. However, my exercise is deliberately focused here on the Tadbirat itself and its particular context. So let's start with the content. So the spirit about which Ibn Arabi is talking in the book is the first existence, simply. It is a secondary cause in relation to absolute being, but is the primary cause of everything in relation to conditioned being, of being al-muqayyad. It is also the prime matter, al-madat al-ula, not the hayula, but al-madat al-ula. So that implies for Ibn Arabi that everything is situated within the spirit, which is, of course, very important when we talk about the body, because as we shall see at several instances, the spirit is not in the body. It is the body which is in the spirit. There is no real other. Everything is just manifesting in the spirit. The body or matter are therefore dimensions of the spirit. There is nothing but spirit here. The body itself is the site of correspondence with the entirety of creation, of manifestation, in all its detail. It mirrors the different types of water, fresh, salty, brackish, the four elements, the varieties of wind, and the various species of animals, including personalities and temperaments that are detailed in the treatise. The treatise shows, of course, how the microcosmic, macrocosmic interrelation works and how we can find everything of the cosmos in the human body. Each of these realities of manifestation have a precise correspondence within the human body. So it is within the body that the caliphal function of the spirit and that the caliphal function of the perfect human being is manifested and fulfilled. They are not separated, as we will see. The body is therefore a manifestation. It is a tajalli of the spirit. As the spirit is the first existence, the first manifestation of the divine reality or of al-wujud al-mutlaq, as Mukhtar talked about before the lunch, the body itself is a tajalli of that spirit. Might we then say that the spirit is in turn the majla, the site of manifestation of the body, that we have the same correlative correlation between the body and the spirit that we have between al-haq and the haqa'iq, famously in Ibn Arabi, or between the real, capital R, and the realities, or the well-known dialectic between being, wujud, and essences, ayan, ayan, or the essences being manifestation of being, of course, manifestations, plural, of being, but being in self, being the locus of manifestations of the ayan, a theme regularly developed by Ibn Arabi in the Futuhat, or al-haq, the real or ultimate truth, being the locus of manifestation for the properties, for the ahkam. So in a sense, we can see, we can say, and we can see the spirit as the locus of manifestation for the body. The spirit is therefore described by Ibn Arabi as universal and singular. Its apparent multiplicity, the bodies, the human bodies in plural, arises from the diversity of the bodies upon which that universal and singular spirit flows. Just as sunlight appears differently depending on the bodies that reflect it, and as a given manifestation is called spirit, just as one may refer to a place illuminated by the sun as the sun itself, says Ibn Arabi. We say that there is sun there. No, there is a reflection of the light of the sun, but we commonly say there is sun. So we say there is spirit in that body. No, there is a reflection of the one only true ultimate spirit. So there is a relationship between individual spirits and that universal spirit. Just like in the political images used in the treatise, there is a relation between the provincial governors and the imam of the state, the caliph itself. We shall say that see that in detail. But also in one of the commentaries in Bayt HaMani, there is an interesting image to articulate humanity as a whole, humanity as a collective reality, and individuals, in which Bayt HaMani says that the Adamic reality comes from the Muhammadan reality, as we've seen in Mukhtar's presentation, and the Muhammadan reality itself comes directly from the divine reality. So the human being is like a mushaf, like a copy of the Quran, says Al-Bayt HaMani, the Quran being the single words of God. But that single word of God is copied in a variety of forms, differing in size, in value, in beauty, containing truthfulness of error of copying. But they all partake in the original mushaf. All those copies of the Quran are just one Quran. Each copy is independent and is in itself one mushaf. The world of God is one, says Bayt HaMani, and is not multiplied through the copies. Rather, it is the copies that are multiplied through the world, the word of God. So that makes the general frame in which the image of the human being is set in the Tadbirat. But then problem arise, and there is an intrigue at the heart of the caliphal order, because the internal dynamics of this microcosmic human reality bring with them a degree of disruption. The order of things, precisely because it reflects the full range of universal possibilities, is unsettled. And Ibn Arabi encapsulates this tension in the form of an allegorical narrative, a form of a story, staged within the caliphate of the spirit itself, an intrigue at the heart of the caliphal order, as I called it. So basically what happens? We have the caliph, which is the spirit, the that singular universal reality of the spirit, which has a wife, which has a queen, which is the self, which is the nafs. The wife is the site of transformation, where alteration and refinement unfold within the kingdom. And she is the pedestal, the kursi, to the throne of the spirit. The caliph has also a vizier. He has a minister who works for him, who is taking care of his affairs, as we shall see, who's the intellect, al-aql. But there is another important character who is the general, mighty and obeyed, the general of passion, of hawa, the amir. And he has also a lieutenant, a vizier, who is desire, shahwa. And that general, he parades each day through the domain of the castle of the caliph with his troops and horsemen. He shows his power every day to the caliph and to the court. The caliph's favorite, the self, the nafs, scorns him, and thus passion falls into obsession, inflamed by this rejection. So the general of passion resorts to cunning, seeking every means to approach her, sending all sorts of gifts and go-betweens. The caliph remains outside of that. He remains even, and that's very striking when you read the text, the caliph himself remains unaware, unmoved, and impassive when he sees that. It is the vizier intellect who keeps watch over the kingdom, actually. The caliph is, of course, above, is beyond all those intrigues. So it is beyond, through the vizier intellect that the caliph becomes aware of the plot that is unfolding. It's only because the intellect is addressing the spirit that the spirit takes care about what's going on in the human kingdom. The human self is thus caught between two powers, which are both vizier, which are not the thing in itself. Neither the caliph, neither the amir of passion itself, but the vizier of the caliph, the intellect, and the vizier of passion, which is desire. The city, the capital of the caliphate and its center, is thus troubled and divided. We have a whole geopolitics of the human kingdom unfolding, in which we have the case of the one who's disobedient to the human order, to the divine order, sorry. And it is the one in which passion governs the province, which we shall see is the body, is the material aspect of the human reality, where the intellect still governs the city. But then we have the hypocrites, where the intellect actually governs the body, but the passion governs the city, governs the inner intellectual faculties. Whereas the believers and the protected are those where the intellect governs both the province and the city. The state of the kingdom thus depends on the way in which the various human faculties are brought into harmony. Those of the city, the spirit, the intellect, the soul, the self, and those of the province, the body, the sensation, and the affects. But in the end of the story, What Ibn Arabi tells is that basically, and I'm making it short, but it's a very beautiful text to read. It's a whole chapter of the book, and it's worth reading as a story full of teachings and wisdom. But basically, the caliph and the vizier, the intellect, are powerless in front of that very powerful general. So what does the caliph does? What does he do? He goes back to God. And he says to God, oh, I cannot do anything here. I have no power over the situation. Please help me. And through this, he realizes true servanthood, true iftiqar, true spiritual poverty, and he is the actual caliphate. He is the actual servant, lieutenant of God in the kingdom. It is precisely by fully and completely recognizing its dependence and poverty before the governance of God, that the spirit sees the order of things restored by God himself. So as Ibn Arabi loves to use in other texts as well, it is God who becomes the intercessor between the spirit and the self, because the spirit has accomplished that complete poverty and dependence. The intellect and the self, in turn, submit to the divine governance by placing themselves in the service of the spirit. The governance and order of the human being thus takes place through their full disposition to servitude. It is in servitude that each human faculty becomes integrated into the divine order and fulfills its role in the governance of the caliphate. But then, what is the place for the body in this governance of servitude? As we shall see now, the governance of the spirit necessarily involves the reintegration of the body. The body is not a passive object of the spirit's rule. It fully participates in its governance. Even though it is situated within a hierarchy of servitude that mirrors the divine order, still, the caliphate is only realized through and in the body. As Ibn Arabi states in chapter 8, the city has meaning only because there is a province. If the province rebels, the kingdom falls. And the state is a body whose spirit is the king. The whole state is a body, ultimately, as the commentator Baitamani says. Thus, all the organs and sensations of the body, the entirety of bodily experience in its detailed dimensions, are brought back to the spirit in the form of taxes through the mediation of the imagination which gathers and unifies them. Ibn Arabi has different chapters in which he details how every sensation, every organ of the human body is actually collecting taxes for the state, for the kingdom, for the caliph, and how these sensations are going to the spirit. It is through the faculty, through the general collector, which is al-khayal, the imagination, who is only capable of having a unified vision of all those sensations. At some point, he details things in that way. Perception of the senses are raised first to imagination, and it becomes then products of the imagination. These products of the imagination are raised to memory, and these memories are raised to reflection. These matters of reflection are raised to the intellect, and what become in the intellect intelligibles are then brought to the spirit because they are disengaged from the body. They are in pure intelligibles now. And it's only then when they are brought to the spirit itself, that they become arwah, that they become not only intelligibles, but spirits in themselves. No. And then the spirit raises all those spirits, all those arwah, to the holy presence itself, in front of which it becomes secrets, asrar. Now they are unknown to anybody except for the holy presence. But what is interesting is the comment that Ibn Arabi makes them. He says, there, inward and outward, law and reality, the work of the body and that of the heart are joined in the presence of the intellect. Everything is reunited in front of the intellect. So everything has not been abstracted from matter. It has been reunited until the highest level, but it's still connected to the lowest level, to the asfal as-safilin, to the bodily experience. This gathering of the dispersed elements of bodily experience is thus aimed not at distancing the body from the spirit, but at reintegrating the body within the spirit. As we shall see, the governance of the spirit must necessarily give rise to an action that passes through the body. The spirit knows because it acts through the body, but the body is governed because it is known within the spirit. A striking example of this lies in the remark Ibn Arabi makes concerning the envoys of the general of passion. In the story, I told you that the general of passion is sending envoys and gifts to the self. And how should the caliph treat those envoys? What should he make of them? He should not fight them. That's very interesting. He should welcome them. He should treat them well. The caliph must grant an audience to the envoys of passion, and he should ask the intellect, he should ask his vizier, to translate his words. He should not speak of itself because he's too big, too beautiful. The spirit, I mean, is too powerful. So he should go through the diplomacy of the intellect, for he is a refined diplomat, says Ibn Arabi. And then that beautiful remarks, if you observe that in our time, those who aspire to God do not attain felicity, it is because they do not attend these diplomatic sessions between the spirit and the envoy of passion. They speak harshly to these envoys, so they scorn bodily pleasures, desires, sensations, etc., without any diplomacy. That is why you see them embark on the path of goodness, but fail to persevere in it, and Satan loathed them. I found that passage really, really amazing. So, in the end, it is through its capacity to integrate the entirety of the body and of the bodily experience that the spirit manifests its authority and enacts its governance. An amazing passage also is where Ibn Arabi says that for the common people, the city is also a province. So we saw that there is that dichotomy between the city and the province. The city being the inward, the province, the outward. And that in this city, we have the self, the intellect, the spirit itself, but all sorts of things going on. But for the common people, the people that are not going on the spiritual path, even that inner dimension is a province. It means that they are not in the proper state of putting the city in the divine order, in the servitude of the caliph. For their heart has not yet been conquered. And it is an interesting parallel to the title of the famous title of the Al-Futuhat al-Makkiyah, the conquest of Mecca. Of course, it can mean the illuminations of Mecca, but it's also it can mean the conquest of Mecca. And Mecca is what is it is the heart. If you conquer, conquest Mecca, you do not conquest from Mecca the other territories around the caliphate. You conquer the heart, the inward dimension of the caliphate, isn't it? But the Muhammadan model of the caliph, the Muhammadan model, he calls him it here. For him, the province is the external world, meaning that the whole of the body is the city. He has integrated in the spirit the whole of his body. So the caliph is thus, in a sense, incarnated in the body, even though the question of his precise localization remains very delicate. It is a delicate metaphysical, cosmological, but also theological question, of course, so much that Ibn Arabi devotes an entire technical chapter as soon as chapter two to that question. So should we consider that the caliph is really incarnated? Is he present in matter? Is it there with the body? Because we saw that the body should be considered in the spirit and not spirit in the body, but actually does it go as far as that? But be that as it may, the caliphate, we see, is clearly inseparable from the body, whose very structure is in fact reflecting that of the spirit itself and that of the divine order itself. So this correspondence between the body and the spirit, the structure of the body and the structure of the spirit, is particularly evident in its quaternary structure. We talked today about binary ternary, and here we've got the following number, which is four. The quaternary structure is both present in the spirit and in the body. The number four is the sign of the natural dimension of the body, the four elements, the four humors, the four directions. It is all about the body, but it's also the symbol of synthetic reintegration, states Ibn Arabi, talking about the tetractys, basically the fact that with the four you have the three, the two, and the one, and by additioning them you've got the ten, which is the perfect divine number, famous Pythagorean doctrine also. So what is interesting and is more of a personal speculation is that the four has actually in Arabic the shape of the ayn. It is very very close to the shape of the ayn, and we can maybe understand that there is a suggestion also that all essences are but manifestations of a single essence. The ayn are all but ayn wahida, as Ibn Arabi also constantly says. But beyond that, we see that the creation, the whole of manifestation, revolves around four worlds. Ibn Arabi says in the Tadbirat, the upper world, the world of alteration, the world of habitation, and the world of relations. So it's an interesting distribution in which all the realities of manifestation are found, 20 in the upper world, the first being the Muhammadan reality, and then the throne, the pedestal, al-Bayt al-Ma'mur, the visited house, the angels, and the celestial spheres, etc. 15 in the world of alteration, which are the four natural qualities and the four humors, plus the seven strata of the earth. Four in the world of habitations, which are the four natural reigns, and 10 in the world of relations, which strikingly are the 10 categories of Aristotle. So the world of reason, of logic, is a world in itself. It's a reality in itself that's part of the that structure of reality. And all of these, concludes Ibn Arabi, are contained within the human being. All these levels are present in the human being. For one of the commentators, Al-Baytamani, the human being exists through four modes of being, which he calls wujudat, interestingly. So there are four beings, not existence, nor modes of being. There are four beings, four ways of being. I don't know how to translate that here in this context, of the human being at once. The first is the being of the human being in the knowledge of God, which is again related directly to what Mukhtar presented earlier, because Baytamani says that's the meaning of the famous Quranic verse in which God talks about the human being as when you were not yet a thing, in Surah At-Tawbah, Surah 9. Then the second being of the human being is in the word of God, and it's the being in the kun, in the injunction to exist that God gives him. Then the third being of the human being is in the book of God, which is the preserved tablet, the Imam Mubin of the Quran. And then the last one is the Adamic form. The Adamic form, which by Tamani precise, is determined by modality and quantity in the sensory world, and that is the meaning of the verse of Surat Al-Imran. It is he who forms you in the arham, in the wombs, as he wills. There is no deity but him, the Almighty, the All-Wise. Every other existence of the world, as Beit HaMani, follows the exactly same schema. They are all in those four level of existence at the same time, because they are all manifestations of the human being, and they were all created from the reality of the human being. This correspondence between the body and the spirit also appears to converge in the notion of the throne, in which spirit and body seem to be brought together by Ibn Arabi. In chapter 1, the throne is the name of the spirit. The spirit is actually Al-Arsh. It is the throne that encompasses the entirety of the human world, of course. But the throne in another chapter is the body of the human being in the upper world, in the first of the four worlds we just saw. It is the seat of the governor in chapter 9, whereas the pedestal is the seat of the soul or of the self, the kursi. And in chapter 5, the throne is knowledge, which is unity of consciousness, Ibn Arabi precises, whereas the pedestal is action and distinctive consciousness, which goes through the body, as we are going to see now. And the pedestal, the kursi, is the safest and best protected place because it is the house of the prophetic tradition and the elevated, impenetrable citadel of the law. The throne, according to the Quranic image, is borne by 8 bearers, while its pedestal is described as the resting place of the 2 feet. Might then the quaternary structure, the heart of parity, be thus positioned between its double and its half? I don't know. But what is interesting here, it is also well known that there is an association between the throne and Rahmah, and divine mercy, as Gracia talked about this morning. And through this connection with mercy, the throne is then also linked to the Muhammadan reality, which is the primordial manifestation of that divine mercy, as we say, but it's also related to the incarnate presence of the Muhammadan reality in the Muhammadan heir. The union of spirit and body in the human being takes place through the enactment of knowledge. Alluding to the well-known hadith on the multiple levels of Quranic revelation, Ibn Arabi described the reality of the caliph as possessing both a had, a limit or a definition, which is its practical implementation, and a point of elevation, which is the knowledge that guides this action. So the knowledge of the spirit is necessarily always connected in the action of the body. To conclude this overview, let us now turn to the original way in which Ibn Arabi articulates the relationship between knowledge and action in Tadbirat through the image of nourishments. So for Ibn Arabi, the subsistence, and I quote him here, the subsistence of every being depends on something that serves as its nourishment. For example, the nourishment of substance is accident, for it cannot subsist without it. Likewise, the body subsists through composition, the intellect through certain necessary forms of knowledge, and matter subsists through forms. These are nourishments of the other realities. So we see in that chapter, at the very end of the Tadbirat, that actually the spirit is nourishing himself through the body. It is the body who nourishes the spirit. And that spiritual nourishment is described as being in harmony with each season of the earth. And what is very interesting again, and that echoes what we saw before with the envoys of passion, is that this spiritual nourishment in every season is always between ascetic discipline to take the opportunity of each season to get back to the spirit, and then active contemplation in the season. For example, in the spring, after retreat, you should go for a walk and you should go and see the flowers. It's not only retreat, it's not only active contemplation, you always need both. And in autumn, it is the time for the meditation on death. And there is an interesting passage in which Narayana says, meditate on the fact that death is the first phase of birth into the final abode. So death, of course, is the first phase of birth, while this present abode is pregnant with you. That means that your body is like the placenta or the fetus of the spirit. And through death, birth will occur. So we see that the caliphate is both inward and outward. It is founded on a governance of servitude encompassing the whole being, body and spirit alike. And what is interesting is that the treatise aims not to combat imbalances in the human being. The treatise aims at preventing their emergence. In chapter 13, while addressing the army of the Caliphate of the Spirit, Ibn Arabi explicitly states that he does not provide a description of the battle formation of that army. For such a description would be futile because, he says, there is no benefit in doing so. The confrontation should not take place. And how it should not take place? Through the proper nourishment of the spirit through the body. So we need to unite the two kinds of nourishment so that the body may be ready for both acts of worship and intellect reception to spiritual influxes. You will at every moment be a man of knowledge and practice, that to which the law has urged you, commanded, and enjoyed. And actually, talking about nourishment, he has a section in the last chapter on the consult to the aspirant, to the disciple, in which he explains how to practice meditation while eating, while actually eating food, I mean. So how that nourishing of the spirit through action takes place, I will conclude with that passage before a few words. The spirit lives by divine knowledge, but divine knowledge is only made manifest through action. Whatever the body has not consumed and from which it has derived no benefit will be expelled in the form of excrement that you will discard in the latrine. Likewise, you perform works and extract from them their spiritual essence in the form of knowledges and degrees. And then you discard the rest, just as you discard the waste product by that bodily nourishment. These are all the hardships you endured in performing those acts, staying awake at the end of the day, the distances covered to reach the mosque or to walk to the path of God, completing your ablutions in the chill of dawn and all unpleasant situations. All these prescribed works in this world, you will leave them behind and only take them, only take with you into the hereafter the subtle essences that God has deposited in them. Just as you cannot benefit from bodily nourishment without activating its secondary cause, so too you cannot attain spiritual nourishment without setting it in motion. The easiest of actions is to consume it, to consume nourishment. Yet it is through action that you consume it, and action is service. You must therefore shew, move the tongue, the gums, the teeth, the throat, the esophagus, the stomach, the intestines, the liver, and then a spirit of life will circulate with you. But if another consume it, you will derive no benefit from it. The same applies to spiritual nourishment. It is you who must consume it, and then God will give it to you. But most people are blind to the maintenance of the spiritual constitution through that divine nourishment drawn from the work prescribed by the law. So, in conclusion, we see that according to the Tadbirat, the body is not simply a given, passively imposed upon the spirit, and from which it must be emancipated. Rather, the body is revealed to be a dimension of the spirit itself, through which the life of the spirit is cultivated and nourished. The caliphate of the perfect human being thus unites body and spirit in a manner that returns both to their primordial unity. The spirit does not so much inhabit the body, it is the body that is situated within the spirit again. And I will conclude with Ibn Arabi's own closing words inserted just before the final section of the practical counsel to the disciple, but which in truth appear to bring the entire work to its conclusion. Because after having depicted in detail the reality of the human being, Ibn Arabi turns the gaze back upon the reader, upon us, entrusting us with the responsibility of governing the kingdom of being. Do not deceive yourself, O disciple, for I have shown you the image of the thing. So know, be a companion of the intellect, if you so wish, or be a companion of the self. May God Most High set us in order along with you and all the Muslims. Amen. Thank you.